There it is again. Hey everyone, we're live and we're talking today about a couple of things that entrepreneurs forget in their journey. We get distracted by so many things. What are the kind of core things that you need to do, whether you're a startup or, as most of our folks are, scale-ups? Hey everybody, my name is Bill Gallagher, scaling coach, host of the Scaling Up Business Podcast. Our show comes to you every week with stories from experts, entrepreneurs, and others about all the things that they've learned in growing a company, the secrets to beating the odds and being one of the success stories. All our shows and more now for 5 years, hundreds and hundreds of shows now at scalingcoach.com or wherever you're getting this right now, whether it be YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, etc., Stitcher, Facebook, LinkedIn. We've got it for you. Video and audio every week, scalingcoach.com. All right. So we're joined now by Sean Castrina. Sean Castrina is a podcast host and an all-around rock star. He's founder of Weekend MBA. He's a serial entrepreneur. He's done a whole bunch of companies, and he tries to launch a new venture every year. So he's going to share some of his story with us and some, I think, really great essential principles that sometimes we forget in the process of running our businesses and working to grow. Sean, welcome to the show.
It's great to be on the show, Bill.
Thank you. Where are you today?
I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia, right near University of Virginia.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, we were there, nearby there. I was in Charlottesville, what, 2-3 weeks ago, Wanda? At Keswick Hall.
Yes. Yeah. It's great down there.
It's a lovely place. Yeah. So anyway, I'm excited to have you on. I think it'd be great if you said to folks a little bit more about your entrepreneurial story. I think you have a great story about working for others, getting a degree, and then seeing that maybe there was a better way for you.
Share that. There you go. Okay. So I came out of college. I was a Division I college athlete and took a job for free.
What was your sport?
Wrestling. I was a Division I in college. And so I took a job coming out of college to work for free for 90 days. I just figured I'd skip all the rungs on the ladder. So I went to a big organization and said, instead of coming in for, you know, a very low wage, I said, I'll just work for you for free. Fairly confident that I would earn my way there. And I did, you know, the guy I worked for actually lives a few miles from me and his son was a business partner of mine. And this is, you know, almost 30 years later. So had my dream job. I was in graduate school and the head of the organization, ahead of this person that I'm friends with, resigned and, you know, retired and there was a change in leadership. And I remember going into an office and hearing these words. This is where your whole life changes when you hear this. We're going in a different direction. You never want to hear that. Just for anybody out there, we're going in a different direction. We're going in a different direction. That is a code for we just gave you the middle finger. Life kind of literally like slowed down in that 30-second period there. But I have a strategic mind and I just kind of figured, okay, all right, well, there is no such thing as job security. I knew that right there. And I just was like, okay, I'll get a job temporarily. And I'd never, prior to that second, I'd never thought about owning my own company. That's the funny thing. Like, I figured, you know, I'd be a type of person to work my way up the ladder and be a CEO or something like that. I just had that kind of personality, competitive athlete. You know, I'm just going to, okay, here's the top. Here I am. Okay, how do I get there? That's just kind of how my brain works. And I was fine with that. But then when this happened, you know, I had to go in a different direction and did. I started selling insurance, life insurance. Now, next to selling drugs, selling insurance is actually really profitable from what I understand. And it's the first time I ever saw like really crazy expensive cars and crazy expensive lifestyles. In my 1 year, I remember going to lunch with the one guy that I worked with and he had lost like $250,000 like gambling. And I'm but he's worth millions. And I'm like, well, gosh, you know, I'm just thinking that, I guess you're so rich, it doesn't matter. He goes, don't ever kid yourself. $250,000 hurts no matter who you are. But it's the first time I really met really crazy wealthy people with selling insurance. And I was in a sales meeting. And this is how my entrepreneurship journey happened. And what I'm getting ready to tell you is kind of what's made them last 30 years. So I'm sitting in this sales meeting and I'm seeing all these really nice cars out in the parking lot and mine. which was not that nice. It was a long meeting. And I'm like, you know, what if, just one of the brain farts, if I could get somebody to come to this parking lot and clean my car while I'm in this meeting? Because when I get out of it, I really need to go find a car wash and get it cleaned.
Yeah.
And right there, you know, this idea hits me. What if I could get like a van and they could put water in it? Now, this is 30 years now, but 30 years ago, that was not like nobody was doing that. And so I started a company called Waxmaster Mobile Detailing. And this is why it's unique. I could care less about car wash, car cleaning a bit car. I've never cleaned a car since then. I never cleaned a car then. I never cleaned a car since then. It was not a sexy business. Wasn't even a business I liked. But it was a business that I knew would make money. I knew would work. Because I knew everybody in that sales meeting agreed with me they'd pay to get their car clean. So I started that company. I did a 50-50 split at the end of every week. I created up the marketing. I had, you know, when you called, you spoke with a person and they just lined it up, you know, inside, outside, do you want both? Is it a, you know, an SUV or is it a car? You know, four different pitches. And I made $30,000 without having to do anything. And I knew then that was the, you know, the bright light came on. Like, okay, I like companies that involve human beings. I still do. I don't like any business that competes with Amazon, software, AI. You know, I doesn't interest me. It's not my skill set. So I like, it involves a human being because, you know, Amazon can't do that. AI can't do that. Software can't do that. None of them can do what a human being can do, whether it's taking out a, you know, a dent in your bumper. And I started that and that worked. And I've rinsed and repeated that formula for over 30 years and owned millions and millions of dollars in home service companies. Using that same formula, it doesn't need to be sexy. I started a handyman company a few years after that. It's an eight-figure company, you know, and that just went into more and more and more. Now I own a huge digital marketing company. Same concept. A human being can't quite do what we do. We actually meet with local business owners, go over their reports every month and show them, hey, this is what we did. We had the human element to it. But the point is, you know, other than digital marketing company, none of them were sexy companies. None of them were businesses I was passionate about. Could care less. I'd sell toilet seats if I thought it was a good market and I could make money because it'll pay for all the things I am passionate about, playing golf, being generous, being philanthropic. We get it backwards, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We feel like it's the business has to be our passion. Well, okay, I'm passionate about golf. I have no idea how I'd make money doing it. What does it mean? I buy a driving range or I buy a Top Golf in Charlottesville, Virginia, of a city of 60,000. It doesn't make sense if you think about it.
What doesn't make sense?
Being the in fact a business, that you have to start a business that you're passionate about. That, if you really think, I had this conversation with John Tesh on his podcast, and he and I went round and round for 10 minutes and finally he gave up and he goes, you're right. My first business that went out of business was a running store. And he goes, I loved running and I went out of business because there wasn't a big enough market for it. And I was just.
Well, I think that like I hear two things consistently. Yeah. One is, if you're passionate about something, then you probably will pour your heart and soul into it. Like you're willing to work really hard, right? But on the flip side, you might not be very objective about the business opportunity, which is what I think you're speaking to.
Exactly. My point is that I'm passionate about all these other things. Well, to do all these other things, I need freedom and I need to make a pretty good living. Yeah. You can get it in reverse. In other words, I'm passionate about, I love the fact that I play golf this morning, I'll play tennis and what other thing. All these things, but if my business doesn't do well, I can't do any of these things. So I just think that you have to be careful. I talk about a Bermuda Triangle of starting businesses and ideas. We get these ideas and what our tendency is to find something we're super passionate about. And I'm just saying, are you willing to run it through the same beta test that you would do any business plan or startup? The tendency is when you're passionate about it, you bypass that. The only beta test you have is, I like it. I'm passionate about it. Assuming there is a market waiting for it when you're the only objective. You don't run it through the objective test is my point.
Yeah. What are the other parts of your Bermuda Triangle there?
Yeah. The second one is you hire friends and family. You know, your first critical hires, they are critical. You know, I mean, Bill Gates hired Steve Ballmer. Okay, there you go. You know, Steve Jobs hires Tim Cook, and you can kind of go down the line. Mark Zuckerberg hired Sheryl Sandberg. No family and friends in these early hires. But we do. And we do that. Well, they don't confront us. They're grateful to have a job. And you start off with just tremendous mediocrity. And, yeah. Because you don't do the hire that moves the needle.
Yeah. If you hire the thing closest at hand. Well, I think it's interesting is you start out, and we've talked about this with a few past guests, being interested in seeing a problem worth solving. And that's a really useful thing. And an awful lot of entrepreneurs start off with something that they like to do, can do, an area they're interested in, right? And they try to turn that into a business, but they can lose some objectivity is what I hear you saying there, which is, I think, really a valid, valid point.
Or you get caught being the technician because you're so in love with it that you're the baker and now you're the lead baker. You have a bakery and you're the lead baker. And it doesn't allow you to be the entrepreneurial addict that can keep starting new businesses. Example, I've never once ever heard Jeff Bezos talk about his passionate love for books, yet he started Amazon. I've never had anybody in any interview ever heard Jeff Bezos say, the number one product that I love since the day I was was books. I sat and read books. No, it was the number one SKU. It had the biggest product. There's more product, different products and books than any other single product line. So if you can kind of get that, all the rest will fall easily. If you can figure out how to sell every book that's possibly out there, that's that was kind of the beta model to be able to do everything they're doing today. But I've never heard him talk about his passionate love of books, but that was Amazon.
Yeah. So you figure out very early on, find a problem, fall in love with the problem and figure out how to solve that problem without doing it yourself.
Yeah. Right? Never do it myself. And here's a key point, Matt, you got to have a massive market. Unless you're selling, yachts, airplanes, you generally need a very demanding market. So I like to find something where there's a problem that's, that I can solve, my business can solve it, where there's a tremendous demand for it within the area I live. Okay. Example, I wouldn't have a surf shop in Charlottesville. You got to use some common sense here. And I find that people in their businesses, they don't go into it objectively. Again, they take an idea, they're passionate about it, they run with it, they have no idea whether it'll work, they just like it. Number two is they hire family and friends. And the third biggest problem why businesses fail is they're a schmuck. You can't fix stupid, you can't fix lazy, you can't fix undisciplined, you can't fix unlikable. Only Steve Jobs got away with being an a-hole. The only one. Only one, who had just a personality that, didn't gel. He got fired, okay? I mean, they got rid of him and then brought him back a decade later. I mean, generally, you have to have certain qualities as an entrepreneur to be successful as an entrepreneur. I mean, we sometimes forget that, half of them do fail and 90% fail by the 10th year. It's a hard business.
It's interesting. A lot of people who worked for Steve Jobs, including some I know, say, Steve was demanding, was not the easiest person to hang with, but he demanded the best of you, and the abrasiveness you knew was calling for a better you and better work. And so they took it. And I think there's something there to that. Like, that Elon Musk is extraordinarily innovative, and yet he seems kind of like an oftentimes a jerk too. Puts his foot in his mouth and says,
"And there's no." I think with
Steve Ballmer was an epic a-hole.
Yeah, I was gonna say with genius typically comes with it. But I'd say to you, listen to me. When you're Elon Musk, you can be that. I mean, if you're in that outlier, you earn the right. I would say Nick Saban is probably that way. Okay, to be fair, I got to a lot of the highest echelon they are because they're so maniacally focused.
Demanding, focused. Yeah.
Right. But I don't think we get through that our first startup business. We got to earn that right.
We've been talking about things that really work. I'm curious, stories or examples of things that you screwed up. I know you like to tell
the podcast is limited, right? Length. We're going to do the 24-hour marathon here, audience. So just line up, get a pillow. The biggest thing I failed in is hubris. When you start businesses, you feel like anything you do will work. I took a business that I knew nothing about, and it wasn't even a problem. I started a retail business. So stupid. And it went under within 3 years. And there was nothing about it that I should have touched. It wasn't like it didn't solve a problem. It was just kind of like, I just thought I could, I just thought I could make money with it. To me, it was like, it looked too easy. Mm-hmm. If something looks too easy, there's a reason. It's not. And so, I lost a lot of money and I learned that it had no synergy with anything. It had no synergy with my existing companies. It didn't fall in that model of human beings and service oriented. It didn't fit anything, but I could make it work. You know, I see like an opening store in like the mall of ours, like they had an open, I'm going to just throw a business in there. I mean, that's a great location. I'll make it work. Yeah. Didn't work.
Yeah. I think there's something there for a lot of us who at one point or another have had an idea, and there's definitely different classes of entrepreneurs. There are ideation founder types who are brainstorming ideas all the time and often script their companies because they've thrown too many ideas in them, right?
Yeah. Now, I mean, I try to be really focused on one thing at a time, you know, business-wise for my company, one clear objective. We try to add one revenue stream a year. I define that as anything $250,000 or more. Anything under that is just part of the way we do business. I don't consider it that, but I try to add something, build something, win in our company, add a division, add a new business, but something that brings $250,000 of revenue.
So when you look back at the car wash business, car mm-hmm. detailing, you did car washing, detailing, everything?
It was auto detailing, just pure auto detailing.
So did you figure out if there was any competition? Did you compare what it cost to get someone to do it versus what you could charge for it?
Stuff. And that's why I wrote my book, The World's Greatest Business Plan, because your business plan doesn't have to be rocket science, but everything you mentioned you do need. Who was our competition at the time? No one. Car washes. Okay. Nobody was bringing water to your house. Okay. Or to that. So that's why it was so good. Pricing, we figured a little under $100. There were some people doing detailing at shops at the time, but nobody came to you. So we kind of kept our model just a touch less than theirs, but we would make it a little more convenient. They were about 129. We were 99. This was like 30 years ago, which was actually really good money. I think you have to do all the above. You got to know your competition is. You got to know what your value proposition is. Ours was we were going to come to you, which gave us a unique advantage because we weren't wasting time picking up your car, driving it somewhere. You know, sometimes you'd go pick it up, bring it to your shop, clean it, and then drive it back. There's liability in there and all that. So we felt like we had something really unique. And that same model I've used in every business since then. You know, I'll give a great piece of, you know, something you can take for what it's worth, your audience. If you want to figure out how to set up a company, this is kind of what I do. Find the one promise that if you could make and deliver on that your competition isn't, that is so good people would chase you down for your business. Think about Domino's Pizza at one point. It was bringing you a hot pizza in under 30 minutes. Extraordinary value proposition. It literally separated them from every pizza delivery place. That one sentence, that it was a very audacious promise to be able to get you pizza that was kind of hot within 30 minutes. I mean, they drive through your neighbor's backyard to get it to you. Don't get me wrong. But the point is it worked and it separated them from everybody. If you got to have a promise that so separates you from your competition, then you got to figure out how to deliver on it. That's the hard part. But that's what should be in your brain. When you're looking to start a business, like people would chase us down Amazon. If we could get you everything within 24 hours, Walmart, if we could create a store within, not big cities that have everything at a fairly affordable thing. I mean, you can look at all the great businesses. That's what they did. Every one of them. Southwest Airlines, what if we could create, lower end flights? You know, how could we do it? That's exactly what they did. You can go, Microsoft, what if we could create an operating system that, boom. Back then you had to type in like all the codes and stuff to do a computer. Remember like the Commodore computers and stuff? And they created Windows. You know, all the great ones find the one thing that's so good that if they pull it off, people would chase them down for their business. Warby Parker with, how they did glass, buying glasses online. You can keep going down the line, the ones that did it. That's the secret, that one audacious promise that you can deliver on.
Solving a problem or finding a problem, figuring out how to solve it, right? Yeah. That's the crux of
it. And solving it in a way that's better than everybody. I mean, there's problems out there, but everybody's solving them kind of the same way. You got to find a unique way of solving it. At the end of the day, you got to, you know, competitive advantage. Why should I do business with you as opposed to them? You always got to answer that question. And that's why I like this one promise concept that I've always talked about, because if I line you up next to your competition, what's your promise compared to theirs? Like Zappos, 1 year warranty. I remember that years ago. I'm like, that's got to be impossible. But they must have did the math and realized that, heck, you know, after like 2 months, people don't send things back anyway. But they have a 1 year warranty. Wear it, they don't care. That's at the time when you're doing clothing and shoes, when you don't order things online because you're afraid it isn't going to fit. And they're like, no, you got a year.
Yeah.
That was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's probably why, you know,
I think
bought them for $1 billion.
It really is about differentiators. I was very loyal for years to Nordstrom, and they would go over the top to fix things and take care of things for me. And one time the cleaners lost a pair of pants to one of my suits. And back when I wore suits. Yeah. And so I go in and I'm like, hey, I love this suit, and the cleaners lost the pants, and they've looked high and low and they can't find them anywhere. And I've given up. And is there any way that you could reorder the pant for this suit?
Absolutely.
And they said, oh, we'll take care of it right now. And they went out, they found that same suit and in the same size. And they go, here you go. Here are the pants off this one. And then they sent it back to the manufacturer and to replace the pants. And so they just gave it to me on the spot. And they said, hey, they'll go do the alterations for you over there, and you'll be ready to go in a couple of days or whatever it was with the suit. And I'm like, oh, my God, it cost me nothing. They fixed my problem. It wasn't their problem. They didn't create the problem, but they just created a super, super loyal customer. Now, as a person who sold to Nordstrom for decades, being on the other side of that also has trade-offs.
So. No, but you're right about you're 100% Nordstrom. I mean, I've heard that story too. I heard where a lady one time brought tires back to him.
Have you heard that story? Ones. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they took it, you know. So, but yeah. But they are amazing,
ever happened, but it's a good story.
Yeah, it is a great story. But I will say that's my first going into a Nordstrom. I will never forget. Really quick, so I remember going up in Annapolis, Maryland. I went up the escalator to the men's section. I literally said, "This is the way heaven will look. You'll be an escalator, and you're going to end up in a Nordstrom men's." Somebody was playing a piano. It was like I'm like this is like shopping Nirvana.
Yeah. So in your day, like today where I live, there's at least a dozen mobile detailing, auto detailing things, right? It's really common. I know other people have scaled them to corporate office parks and everything. It's probably evolved where you are. Can you share some other examples of either your companies or the ones that you've worked with and know that did something different? I'd love to put a few more of those because I know you've got plenty.
Well, that company was Wax Master Mobile Detailing. I did sell it, but they did clean my cars like 3 weeks ago. So they're still around. So it's still a durable business model. I started a handyman company. Everybody's like, well, what's that? Let's think simple here. I'm living in a very nice housing development. I own a magazine in 21 cities. I'm making a very, very good living. I'm like 30 years old. I cannot get anybody to do any work in my dining. I wanted to convert it into an office. And it's hard to get your mojo when you got a chandelier over your head. Couldn't get anybody to do it. I'm asking people in my neighborhood. I'm asking at the pool, the tennis courts. Like, anybody know a great handyman? No. Okay. I launched it, Advantage Handyman. Our fourth week in business, we had 55 phone calls that week for business. 55 phone calls. I knew then I'd hit the Holy Grail. Within 3 years, we're doing over $1 million a year. $1 million a year in a town of 60,000. That's crazy number. Mr. Handyman came to Charlottesville. I put him out. They left within a year. That's how dominating of a stranglehold we had here. Case Handyman sent them packing, sent Mr. Handyman packing, sent Case Handyman packing. These are huge franchises. I do Super Bowl ads, World Series ads. There's no comparison in the stranglehold we did it. But then we just kept adding. We did handyman. Then we added, you know, roofing, siding. We're getting ready to do solar. We have a large scale additions. We've done custom homes. We have a kitchen division, a bathroom division, we had like 9 different divisions within. You just kept rinsing and repeating.
And you're doing different home services, yeah.
Now we have, we own an entire corner of a street. It's huge. Now the idea of a problem. So about five years ago, obviously digital marketing becomes huge. Everybody's kind of doing it different. I'm old school, so I'm typically was postcards and Val packs and TV and radio. So I didn't understand this at all. And my competitors that, worked their way in and all these little niches, that's all they were doing. And I didn't understand. I better figure this out. And so I tried using people all around the country. Google a company, you never knew who they were. They'd send you these little spreadsheets that you never understood. So eventually my radio station, because all the local people wanted to start selling digital marketing. So everybody was trying to pitch me because I had a big advertising budget and I'm a whale if you could nail me. So they come in, I'll never forget this, it was in November, like 4 years ago, I'm meeting with the radio station, they bring in all their bigwigs and they're pitching me on doing digital marketing with them. And I'll share with your audience how you can always find an opportunity. I'm listening to it, the quietest person in the room of theirs was the smartest guy in the room. And everybody gave me their business cards at the end, I threw away all their cards and kept this guy's card. He was the least impressive of their group, the way they were acting, but I knew he was the smartest. And I called him the next day and I said, James, listen, I will hire you guys to do all my digital marketing. We'll use a generous budget, but this is what I want. I don't want you to email me any spreadsheets or all this little reports because I don't understand any of them. Agree to come to my office once a month for 15 minutes and tell me what the hell I spent my money on. Is it working or is it not? What do we need to change that isn't working if it's not? Just 15 minutes. The old George Bush staff meeting. And I said, and oh, by the way, you're going to come work for me or you and I are going to start a company. I said that at the end of it. So he starts doing my digital marketing. That's in November of that year. May of that year, I said to him, I said, hey, James, you ever been to Disney World? You and your family? He goes, no, he's got little kids. No, we haven't been yet, but we'd love to go. I go, great, let me pay for it. I'm going to send your family to Disney World. He goes, well, why would you do that? I said, remember what I told you 6 months ago? You're either going to come work for me or you're going to be my business partner. And this is my down payment. I had no idea what we were going to do then. But you guys can Google this. Gig Strategic, that's one of our companies. Get Started Marketing is one of our companies. 2 years later, we launch them. Okay. They're 7-figure companies. They're incredible. But I had a need. I didn't understand digital marketing. Okay. I found this. I knew James was good at, that's the same formula I use. I don't know anything about home improvements. I have a plastic toolbox upstairs. I couldn't tell you the difference between 2 screwdrivers, but I'm doing millions of dollars in construction. I know how businesses operate. I partner in every single one of my businesses. I have a partner. Kitchens, I have the best kitchen designer in Virginia. I have an interior designer, New York Institute of Art, doing my bathrooms. I have an engineer. I have partners in every single one of my business, just like I did with the detailing company. I did a 50-50 split with the guy who could actually do the detail. I've been doing this now for 30 years. And it's made me millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Well, that's even that's secret. A pretty good thing, right? You said to a guy who does detailing, listen, I'm going to give you business, but I'm going to keep half of it. Right. So you've got to be pretty compelling as it is, because not everybody takes that deal.
No, exactly. But you got to bring the value proposition. You're good at detailing. Great. I said, but I bet you sit home in the winter and you starve and you got to try to go out and do estimates. You're never going to have to go do any of that again. We're going to take care of we're going to keep you nonstop busy. You don't ever have to look at a car again. All you do is show up, clean it. And on Fridays you get paid. Same thing I did with the handyman. I did that same pitch to the handyman. You're never going to have to do this again. We'll generate more work than you could ever have to do. You're never going to be sitting home in the winter starved again. Every construction guy is afraid to sit home in the winter. That's their Achilles heel. And I knew that. And that's the pitch I use when I interviewed everybody. You'll never sit home without work. I tell, listen to me, my superpower is marketing. I'm a young, aggressive guy, and they believed it. They go, hey, you kind of give that impression that you're probably good at it. And I did, and I backed it up. That's why we did Super Bowl ads and World Series ads and all that. Yeah, you got to bring a value proposition to it. James would have never partnered with me, but listen to this offer I made him. I told him first, because his wife was a stay-at-home mom, I said, you need to get a raise from your company. You are, I'm like, you are their digital marketing company. I'm like, do you have a non-compete? He goes, no. I go, oh, big mistake. We're getting ready to make some fun with that. So I showed him what to do, and he went and asked for a raise, and they turned him down, kept turning him down. This is like December. I said, listen, we're starting a company January 1st. I said, how much money do you make? He told me what he made. I said, I'll guarantee your paycheck for the next year. We're gonna launch this business in the next 10 days. We did. I only had to pay his paycheck. He's probably listening to this eventually. I only had to guarantee his paycheck for 1 month. I knew he was a superstar. Yeah. I knew we'd make money fast. And I remember saying to him, I said, James, don't ever get mad at me when I'm making profit sharing, because I knew you were a superstar. I said, in that meeting, there was a lot of people in that meeting, you know what I mean? And I knew you were a superstar. And I sent you to Disney World telling you I was a superstar. So please don't ever get upset when I make a lot of money because I made a bet on you. And and he always says, no, he goes, I'll never feel bad because I would have never did it had you not given me that 1 year guarantee. He said, my wife would have never let me go quit my job and start a business.
Right.
So you got to find something that's compelling. I mean, yeah, people, are not going to do it if you don't.
I think in general, that's a really good approach, and being really straight about it and out in the open is good too. I remember hiring some guys for another company years ago, and they started to figure out how much money the company was making. I'm like, yeah, but wait a minute. I said, what do you want to get paid? How do you want to work? I let you name everything. And now we're taking risk and working in a way that you didn't want to work. And we're trading on that difference. And that's actually worth a lot to people, but it's not a way that you want to work. So chill out and enjoy your work. You got to name your price, terms, everything. And
some people will never. I mean, I've had people I partner with and they never quite get it. And you're an SOB and you're this and you're that. I'm like,
you're taking advantage.
I'm like, no, the fact is I saw the opportunity. I took all the risk.
Yeah.
Occasionally you're going to have that, one in 10 situations.
So you're pointing to something here that I think is really useful, and that's the whole people side of things. So, and attracting and engaging, retaining talent, expertise, and then leadership, right? Because you don't have the expertise in these, and yet you're running multiple businesses with, I'm sure, multiple people in them from the numbers and the things you're throwing around. So what is it that you've learned about attracting and retaining the core talent and the leadership talent? Talk to us about that.
Well, you nailed it. In other words, I'm always interviewing. I'm always looking for talent, and I'm looking for it everywhere. It has nothing to do with an interview. I look for it on the golf course. I look for it if I'm playing tennis. I look for it at my kids' sporting events. I'm always looking for, these are the qualities. Number one, they have an expertise in something that I see as a potential monetization. I see there's money there. Okay. So that's it. They have an expertise. Number two is they're a leader. You can't scale anything without a leader. And I can't lead all these businesses day to day. I got to set the overall culture and vision and make some big decisions, but I can't manage, digital marketing company day in and day out. So they've got to be a leader. Third, got to be a salesman, got to be a rainmaker. They got to have that gift of communicating and everybody does it in a different style. Like James is very to the facts, very detailed and all that. And I have a little bit more of an energy style, but there are a lot of ways to get it done. They got to be a rainmaker, because if not, you got to hire a rainmaker. So then you got two big hires that are too expensive right from the get-go. So they got to be the number one salesperson. They got to be the leader. I mean, you got to hire a unicorn.
You found a problem and you're hiring key talent, and then you're doing something to change the way they work. But that initial hire in your business is a little bit more of a unicorn.
They got to have three things. They got to be a leader. They got to have an expertise, and they got to be able to sell. They got to have those three things. I found anything less than that, they don't move the needle enough. I ought to just make them employees. I mean, I'm going to give you, 50%. These are partners, right? This is a person that's going to have 50% stake, whether it's equity and or profit sharing. I'm looking for people. Another super quick story and how it just, I see it. I interview a supervisor. This was 5 years ago. I'll never forget it. Super talented, but I'm interviewing. He's a UVA graduate. He's a construction guy. He's clean cut. He wants to be a handyman. I'm like, wait, this is insane. I go, I don't know where. He was like a history major or something. I'm like, stop. I have something better for you. You know, I said, you want to make $850 a week? I said, let's do this next interview at my house. So he comes to my house. I hit him with the, you know, hit the garage door opener, the AMG, the BMW, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we go in the foyer, the 20-foot ceilings. And I go, I want you to be a partner in my company. Why don't you run my entire handyman division? And I said, you're going to make a lot more money. I said, I'll guarantee you this $850 a week you want. I said, but I am going to be, I'd be stealing from you to give you this. Listen, his last paycheck, he makes way over $250,000 a year. His paychecks are so big every week, I won't even let my CPA show me the numbers. I get a payroll report. I make her black out his. I don't even want to see it because I'd make my head beat against the desk. I joke, but I do. I won't look at it because he makes so much money. He's making well over $250,000 a year. Every Christmas party, his wife comes up, gives me a kiss on the cheek and whispers in my ear, thank you so much. Well, I could have hired him for $850. If he'd have made $1,200, he'd have killed for me. He makes over $250,000 a year. When you interview people, you've got to see potential in them that they don't even see themselves. We mm-hmm. never saw that in him. I'm going through the interview. I'm like, you're articulate. You got the little bounce in your step. You have energy. You have expertise. You got a degree. You're well-spoken. You're organized. I'm like, oh my gosh, what I can do with you is scary. And we did.
And so then how do you grow the companies after that? What's the people side from there out?
I mean,
who's doing the recruiting of the people? How are you building
all my partners? I teach them how to do, you know, the superpower of always be interviewing. That's what I tell my partners. Always be interviewing. Mm-hmm. You can always hire. If you meet a superstar, there's always room on the roster. Mm-hmm. So we're always interviewing.
That's definitely a golden rule.
It is. There's always room on the roster. So I teach them, you know, it's over a 2 to 3 year period. I teach them kind of what I do, but enough to get them up and going. But they run the day to day. And I like smart people too. I talked about sales, but smart is just not even a non-negotiable. Like we wouldn't even be sitting down talking if I didn't think they were bright. The bright mm-hmm. people can handle, they have great capacity. Smart people mm-hmm. can just do many things at once. People that just aren't very bright, we've met them. Come to my family reunion, okay? We've met them. They're just not overly bright. Super likable, not overly bright. I like bright. Mm-hmm. Just pretty bright.
What's the role or value culture in your companies? Are they all the same? Are they similar? Are there a couple of common rules that you have? Are they each really unique and different?
This is going to like upset everybody. I think culture is the most overblown thing right now.
Definitely will upset our audience, but go ahead.
Challenge our thinking. Challenge your thinking. Number one is that 90% of your people want to come to work, get paid, and go home, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. They want to work in a company that's honest and fair and durable, mm-hmm. sustainable. Mm-hmm. But I think we just try to make this so holistic. You know what I mean? Work is it's only a third of their day. Mm-hmm. When they go home, it's not their job as an employee to think about your company or even care about your company. They're a parent, a husband, a wife. And I think we ask too much of people. Like it's this all in whatever. Now, you know what I ask my employees to do? Our culture is very simple. When you're on a job site, make the decision that you would make if it was your house. That's our overriding culture. If you're wondering how to do something, if it was your house, how would you do it? Don't ever take a shortcut. Number two is all my guys, I don't use subcontractors. So they all get paid by the hour. Why? Because I don't want them to ever rush. So I create a culture in how I run my business, but I don't need to wave 100 flags.
That's like culture, though. That's like, you know, do it like it's your house.
You can create fundamentals, but I don't believe in the never ending. Yeah. You know, I got to wave my culture flag. They know what I'll fire them for and they know what I'll give them a raise for. I mean, I communicate it from the very first interview. I don't want you to ever, you never have to rush. I pay you by the hour. Do you realize if it takes you longer, you get time and a half? So don't ever rush on a job or take a shortcut, because I'm going to tell you what I told you right here at this. I've never asked you to rush on a job. Number one. Number two is, if you're making a decision, make the decision that you would do if it was your home. If you can't reach any of us and you have to make the call is, what would you do at your house? And I hope you do the thing that was right. So I instill that from the beginning, but I don't wave like never ending, you know, kumbaya moments. I think I get, you know, I have a big cop podcast too, and everybody's a culture expert now. I'd love to bring them into my company.
Yeah.
Because they would get, you know, my guys would be giving them the middle finger. You know, it rolls out of the ownership, it rolls out of the team.
That maybe doesn't have games and tokens and things like that, but you have a culture, right?
And I always say this.
And do the right thing and like that kind of thing.
I'm being funny about it, but the problem is what I have with startups. Startups start with culture. Sounds great in theory. Make money. Because if you can't pay anybody, you're not going to have a company to have culture with.
That's the basic, right?
But they do. They all start with the kumbaya. Mm-hmm. You know, no, be profitable. Then you'll have credibility and you'll get the culture. The culture is going to resonate from the ownership and the partners anyway, good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a thief, a liar, you're going to hire people probably very similar to you. They're going to adopt your behavior. If they see you treating clients good and they see you fair, and they read your contracts and you know you're not saying, hey, but man, why don't you add this, try to jack this up, drag this out. You know, they know when you're a shyster.
I think there's some super nuggets in here. Let me recap. Before I do that, let me remind everyone, we bring our show to you every week. All the shows and more at scalingcoach.com. If you want to drop us an email, send a note to scalingcoach.com. info@scalingcoach.com is the email to send to. So easy to remember, right? We've been yammering at you forever and ever and ever. Things I heard here, like, don't forget, fall in love with the problem, not something that you're passionate about. Be passionate about a problem, and it doesn't have to be anything that you have any expertise in. Then get great at people, attracting, finding, developing talent. But don't get silly with things. Remember the basics. You're providing differentiated value. Do something unique and compelling, right? In a town without any mobile detailing, provide detailing if there's a bunch of nice cars sitting outside office parks. Or be a handyman who fix some like basic service business, delivering value for money, doing it better than, or doing something that nobody else does, right? Don't get silly about the whole thing. Like really obvious, basic things, I think is really useful. Fall in love with those problems, get good at the people. Those are the things that I mostly heard. If you want more information, you want to listen to the show, like all that, SeanCastrina.com. We'll put it in the crawl here. We'll put it in the show notes, be all over the place. SeanCastrina.com is where to get more. Also easy to remember. Sean, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, sharing a little bit of your wisdom and experience.
Or I stirred up the pot, but hey, I wish everybody great on their entrepreneurial journey. Yeah.
There's lots of gold in there. Thanks again, everyone, for joining us. We'll talk to you again next time. Big thanks to Vern Harnish, author and creator of The Scaling Up Framework, The Rockefeller Habits, and to the folks at Podfly Productions who get our show out every week, and to Wanda Mitchell there in the background getting our guests lined up, show ready, show distributed, all that and more. Talk to you again next time, everyone. Keep scaling up. Bye-bye now.